Social Services Committee. I am Joe Josephson, the chairperson for the committee, and Senator Moss, Senator Vic Fisher are here, and we have a forum to consider the committee substitute for House Bill 84 relating to smoking in public places and vehicles. I think the persons present are familiar with the contents or intentions of the bill. We have approximately six people who signify a desire to be heard. The record should show that Senator Halford of the committee has entered the room. And instead of outlining the bill for you, I would invite one of the original sponsors, Representative M.M. Miller Juno, to speak first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I very much appreciate this opportunity to speak on this legislation. And I might mention that Representative Clarkson, who's also had considerable input into this, particularly on the enforcement citations section, will be here in a few minutes. At that time, I'd like to ask him to join me at the table. Mr. Chairman, in starting, I should give credit to the prime sponsor, Dr. Fritz, Representative Fritz, who is the prime sponsor for this bill, but is unfortunately traveling this week and is not in town. I only wish that he were here, because in the House, he gave just absolutely superlative testimony, particularly from the medical aspect, of what happens to people who inhale secondhand smoke. I think probably you all have heard that, those arguments, but he did what I consider just an absolutely beautiful job of putting them in perspective and outlining the very clear, conspicuous danger that secondhand smoke, that is the smoke from other people's cigarettes, the threat that poses for people who just unfortunately happen to be in the same room with that secondhand smoke.
Senator Vic Fisher has the chairmanship of the State Affairs Committee, to which this bill is also referred, and perhaps Dr. Fritz would have an opportunity in that forum.
Yeah, he'll be back next week, so that'll work out very well. Mr. Chairman, I'll go through the bill fairly briefly and outline to you what it consists of. I'd say, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman, that at this present time, as you, of course, know, we do have a so-called smoking bill that was enacted a number of years ago. As a matter of fact, I was one of the principal authors of that legislation. I have to say, you know, the good news is that we got a bill on the books. The bad news is that, frankly, it's as weak as water. And it has done some notably good things. It has, I think, tremendously reduced the amount of smoking in elevators, for instance, which a number of us appreciate. On the ferries, it's great. On the starboard side, you can smoke. On the port side, you know, you can't, that sort of thing. That's working out, I think, very well. And in public meetings, there's been a demonstrable reduction in smoking. But basically, that's just about all it does. And I've heard over the years a number of complaints from citizens that they want a lot more in this area than is presently on the books. Hence, this piece of legislation that Dr. Fritz and I and Mr. Russell and Mr. Blocks and a number of others co-sponsored. First of all, in the finance section, I think the tobacco industry, if they follow their usual testimony from the House last year, will contest what I'm going to say, but nevertheless, I think it's absolutely true that numerous studies have shown secondhand smoke to be a significant health hazard. I mean, you always hear the complaints that that's not true, but I think deep down inside, we all know that it's absolutely true. And there have been studies, in fact, that recent court decisions have recognized an emerging right of employees to work in a smoke-free environment, that is, an environment free from secondhand smoke. That smoking does result in increased cost to employers. The Heart Association and others gave us, I thought, very convincing testimony of industrial studies that have shown this to be the case. Therefore, those findings being as they are, the state of Alaska, you know, finds that smoking in any form is a nuisance and a public health hazard, and is therefore prohibited in a number of locations, including vehicles and indoor areas. First of all, in the area of vehicles, we are expanding the number of vehicles that in which it would be illegal to smoke. And incidentally, as I go through this first half of the bill and talk about those areas where it would be illegal, bear in mind, for us non-smokers, that's the good news. The bad news is that pretty soon there's exceptions to all of these, lest anybody think that we're coming down too harshly and not giving the smokers their rights as well. But until we get to the exception clause, Mr. Speaker, the areas where we are tightening down include additional vehicles, for instance, a taxi cab, and I think most of us have had the experience of being in a taxi cab, which is a rather closed environment in the winter in Alaska in particular. And we've had to inhale at least one. one other person's had a smoke in the process. And other areas, particularly the indoor waiting areas or boarding areas for aircraft. I've heard more complaints on this one issue than probably almost anything else, because that's, you know, you have to be there when you get, when your flight is called, you have to go inside. You can't go outside and stand away from the secondhand smoke if you want to. It's, you know, there's just one place to go, and there you are. And right now, smoking is allowed throughout the terminals, including those areas. So this would prohibit the smoking in the waiting areas and boarding areas, except for the exception that we'll get a little bit later. We've expanded the number of places, inside places, where smoking is prohibited. A library, and we've removed the word indoor theater, and we've removed the publicly owned and operated place of entertainment or recreation on the grounds that people's lungs are just as susceptible in a privately owned, you know, public place as a publicly owned public place. And when I say public place, I'm talking about, you know, theaters and other such. We are specifically adding a jury room to the place where smoking would be prohibited on the grounds there that, you know, this is one of those areas that just cries out for inclusion, because a person is in there more or less, if not against their will, at least not with always their consent. I mean, if a person gets called to jury duty and they otherwise qualify, they can't tell the judge, I'm sorry, I don't smoke, and George over here on the jury does, and therefore, you can excuse me. The judge will say, well, I'm sorry, but you're going to serve, and you're going to smell, inhale that guy's smoke. So we've included a jury deliberation room as one of those areas where smoking would be prohibited. We've gone down and included the restrooms of laboratories. I think all of us that don't smoke have had the very unpleasant situation of going into restrooms sometimes that were just so blue and black with smoke that you could literally almost cut it. It's handy under those circumstances that those are restrooms, because most of us, or some of us, end up getting almost sick when we encounter that. We've added the inclusion of retail stores, restaurants, or banks. And we've done that, Mr. Chairman, for this reason. In a sense, those places are discretionary. I guess you don't have to go in a grocery store, maybe even get your neighbor to do your shopping for you. Maybe you don't have to go into the bank. Maybe you can get your neighbor to deposit your check for you. Or if you don't have to see the banker on some business, maybe you can send your letter by your deposit by rail and anything like that. And maybe you don't have to go into a restaurant. Maybe you can just elect never to go into a restaurant. But the fact situation is that you're really, in modern life, you are compelled to go into retail stores, restaurants, banks, and other places of business. And why should a person who goes in such places that hold themselves out to the public and invite the public in and want the public in, why should you go into a polluted environment inside those stores when, in fact, if that very same business were polluting the air through the smokestack, the state, the federal government, and all of us would want that pollution stopped. So this stops that interior pollution from taking place. Now, in some early testimony in the House, one person from the retail community said, well, wait a minute, that's going to make traffic cops and enforcers out of our clerks. That's not the case. That's absolutely not the case. The clerks are not the enforcers. The only obligation on the part of the restaurateur, on the part of the retail owner, on the part of anybody else, is to put the sign up that says it's prohibited in a violation of state law. And then beyond that, if they have complied with that, it's up to the person who wants to complain to trigger the enforcement mechanism, which, as I say, we'll get into a little bit later. But most emphatically, the retail owner, the retail clerk, the retail anybody is not the enforcer of this, provided they have put the signs up that are required saying that smoking is prohibited.
Well, Mr. Wood, I would have some concern about this. Let me put it this way. In a state in which we hopefully will try to build respect for a rule of law, I would not like to see a proliferation of signs which were disregarded by people. In other words, I would not like to see us say, in a kind of overreaching sense, it's okay because we'll put signs up and as long as nobody complains, nothing's going to happen to anybody. Because I think that insinuates that we can have a law on the books and a law that people think applies, but you know, it's like keep off the grass and people walk on the grass. I don't want to get into that kind of thing.
Nor do I, Mr. Chairman. And I didn't mean to imply that nobody would do enforcing. What I meant was that the retailer doesn't have to do that. If a person who is offended by the smoke wants enforcement mechanism here, it's here for him to do it. But it doesn't have to be the retailer that does it.
But let me ask this, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but suppose there is a computer room at a bank with 12 employees, and either 11 are smokers and one are not, or one is a smoker and 11 are not, and they all get along fine, they all agree that whatever is going on in terms of who smokes what and when, they've worked out as human beings accommodating themselves to each other. Maybe the smoker says, I'll only smoke after lunch, and the other people say, that's okay, I can live with that, or whatever. Does this bill affect that kind of a consensual arrangement by non-smokers and smokers alike?
I think it does. I think if you we'll jump ahead just a little bit, but if you jump over here to page 3, line 2, designation of smoking areas, you can see that a person in charge of an indoor area described first at the bill or the vehicle may designate portions of the area or vehicle as smoking sections, and for purposes of this section, the vehicle does not include a taxi cab or limo, because that is, you can't designate 1/4, for instance, of a taxi cab as a smoking section and expect the smoke to stay in that 1/4. So
if you had a large room this size with desks around it, and you knew that there were two people smoking, who were smokers, you could designate the corner by the window as a smoking area.
Yeah, you could. Particularly if you had ventilation in the area. Here we're getting into CND, except as provided in the smoking section designated, it may not be larger than necessary to accommodate the needs of the smoker. So if it is big enough to accommodate the needs of the smoker, that section is okay. However, it does have to meet minimum ventilation air quality standards, because obviously if it's a totally closed environment and there's no place for the smoke to go, even though you designate one corner, it's still going to affect everybody. And so I think the safeguards are there to protect smokers and the non-smokers. And I think the very situations you described will be worked out under the bill. As I mentioned earlier, in fact, as we were just getting to the exemptions, that there are exemptions. A portion of a vehicle, like an airplane, can be designated as non-smoking, and of course the airlines in intrastate service are doing just that right now, doing it very well. We're saying, of course, that smoking by performers on stage, that's obviously got to be okay. We've even identified several places where you can have entire area as smoking if you want to. A cocktail lounge or a tavern, for instance, can be a smoking area in its entirety. It's not the kind of bar I particularly care to go to, but you can do it if you want to. The retail business primarily engages in sale of tobacco products. It doesn't really quite seem right to restrict smoking in that sort of establishment. If you and I charter a bus to drive the legislature out to the glacier and back, in private, if it's a private operation, we can do it. And a place of employment, if all of the employers are smokers, can be designated in its entirety as a smoking area. So I think, Mr. Chairman, that this bill goes a long ways to meet the needs of non-smokers in their not only their desire, but I think their right to avoid smoke that's being generated not of their own doing. But on the other hand, I think it also goes a long way to protect the rights of smokers who do, make the decision that they want to, ingest that stuff into their lungs. And that's their business, as long as they don't ingest it into everybody else's. And I think their rights are protected under here as well.
I don't know if this is Mr. Watson, I mentioned earlier that you joined us.
You're welcome to come up at this time. Mr. Clarkson does a much better job of describing the penalty and other sections like that.
Do you want to do that now?
Yes, you're welcome to come up now.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Representative Don Clarkson. I'm here testifying in favor of House Bill 84. The reason I've been asked to testify on particular portions is because of work done on those portions in the Judiciary Committee. Most of it, I think, except the enforcement provisions, Representative get to that if I could go back to one question that Senator Josephson, you raised with regard to a no-smoking area. I just want to emphasize what Representative Miller has said about air minimum ventilation and air quality standards. There were some questions in the House about whether or not those standards were enforceable or were the most up-to-date. The purpose of the legislation is to ensure that if there is a smoking area designated, that in the remainder of the area, the non-smoking area, that adequate ventilation is provided so that that area will not be affected by the indirect smoke. On the enforcement provisions, the present law says that a person who smokes in an area where it is forbidden under the law is subject to a civil fine of $5 to $25. The Department of Environmental Conservation has promulgated a regulation which has modified that fine to $15 to $25. That has increased the possible minimum fine. The fine under the present law for a failure to post a smoking or no smoking sign is a range of $10 to $100. Once again, a civil fine imposed by the Department of Environmental Conservation.
Don, let me ask you, would you run back over that again? Failure to post a sign now, the fine for that too?
There are basically two violations of the present law. One is smoking in an area where you're not supposed to, and one is failure to post a sign indicating that it's a smoke-free area.
Indicating that it is a smoke-free area.
Right.
No smoking.
Yeah, I know. But my God, I think this one.
Anyway. Present system, the civil fine in the law of $10 to $100. The Department of Environmental Conservation has adopted regulations indicating that the fine for a first offense will be $50 and the fine for a second offense will be $100. That's the regulation for failure to post a no smoking sign. That is the old law. Under the new law, Mr. Chairman, there will be four, if I can lay it out this way, four different methods of enforcing the proposed new law. And let me emphasize, Mr. Chairman, that the reason for my interest in this portion of the law is because I agree with you completely with regard to people ignoring the law. It is not a good thing in a democracy to pass a large number of laws that are routinely ignored. Mr. Chairman, the present law on smoking or non-smoking in this state is routinely ignored. And as far as I'm concerned, if we did nothing more and improve the enforcement of the existing law, we would improve the situation. Obviously, I support the parts of the law that revised and expanded the present law, but enforcement is the greatest problem in the area of our non-smoking law. So with that said, there are four new proposed enforcement mechanisms. The first is a civil fine, which is initiated by a complaint by the Department of Environmental Conservation, roughly similar to the existing portion of the enforcement under the existing law, a $10 to $50 fine for smoking in a no-smoking area, and a $20 to $300 fine for failure to post the proper signs. There is a provision indicating that that civil fine can be established as a mail-in mechanism. You can pay your fine by mailing it in, similar to a non-moving violation, like a parking ticket. The second part of the new enforcement mechanism in this law will be criminal penalties, which will be initiated by the issuance of a citation by a police officer with a potential $300 fine. And once again, there's a provision that says that a system of bail can be established, similar to parking tickets and such, so that you can pay this just like you can a parking ticket. That is, there is no mandatory court appearance so long as the fine does not exceed $300. Third part of the enforcement mechanism is the possibility that either the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation or any, quote, affected party, close quote, can file a civil lawsuit and seek an injunction in court for, quote, repeated violations. That is, where there is a repeated and serious violation by a single store or a single Department of State government, for example. The mechanism is available for either the Department of Environmental Conservation or a private citizen to file an injunctive lawsuit. And fourthly, the enforcement mechanism, Mr. Chairman, of the of public education. It is an effort to put into this law a mandatory requirement by the Department of Environmental Conservation to engage in a public education effort about not only the provisions of this law, but about the damage caused by smoking and by secondary smoke. That's a point I want to just emphasize to you, Mr. Chairman, the question of whether or not secondary smoke is merely a nuisance or a health hazard. A great deal of testimony, both written and oral, was presented to the House Judiciary Committee. There are, I'm told, over 30,000 studies that have been done on the question of damage caused, if there is any damage caused by secondary smoke. I am convinced that it is a health hazard. I would not support this legislation if I did not think it was a health hazard.
Senator Halford had a question.
Don was probably the best one. The provisions that apply to employees in the business, that doesn't matter how many employees there are, includes one employee.
I believe that's correct.
That's correct, except that if there's just one, then it's 100% smoking or 100% non-smoking.
Well, so the point is somebody owns his own small office downtown that's in an interior one of these buildings. He wants to hire a secretary. Does that mean that as soon as he does that, he's either going to stop smoking or hire somebody that does smoke? And further beyond that, what about discrimination on the basis of smoking or not smoking as far as employees are concerned?
The answer, if I understand you correctly, the answer to the first question is, keep in mind, this is the thrust of this is toward public being forced to breathe that smoke. So if you'll read in here, there's a number of areas where it talks about public areas, particularly. That excludes, of course, office buildings, like state office buildings, but we take particular interest in public areas. So if you had two or three smokers who were serving the public, it's not just the interest of those two or three
but that's
employees.
Not what this says with regard to place of employment. It has no limitation. It just says place of employment. And what I'm wondering is where your numbers come in here.
The place of employment, if all the employees are smokers, but this exception does not include reception areas, waiting areas, et cetera, open to the public.
Right. Smoking is prohibited unless.
No, I mean, suppose I did nothing in my work except have an Apple computer in my office, call my stockbroker, and invest and trade for my own account. And I had a secretary to keep, a bookkeeper come in. And really, the public didn't call on me because I went to my banker and I went to the stockbroker and left the office. And my secretary remained to take messages from me. I'm a smoker. I don't happen to be a smoker, let the record show. In that situation, would I be violating the law by smoking in my office if my secretary went out to smoke?
You would not if you designated an area and provided the ventilation, which could incidentally be one of these mechanical smoke meters, to protect the health of your secretary.
I could designate, for example, my inner office as my smoking area, and she could be non-smoking areas.
Absent such a designation, yes, you would.
And suppose someone's in this situation right now, and he's got an interior office in one of the buildings in town. It's a single office, but he has exactly that. He's a stockbroker, rental broker, whatever he is. This law passes. The secretary says, you've got to quit smoking. He says, you've got to find another job. What happens then?
This would be a constitutional amendment.
The answer is clear that the law prohibits that situation. The practical answer for that is some sort of device that keeps the air clean enough for both of them. That's a practical answer.
that I would like to know. We were talking about how to eliminate the problems of people smoking in these buildings and things. One of the areas that you have is in a school. It says, page 2, line 3, a school is included as part of the area that you may not smoke in. Over on page 3, we have designation. These are exceptions of smoking sections. I don't know of anything that, and it gives it, it says that the person in charge of the area may, or whatever, may designate portions of the area. What I'm seeing now in our public schools, Mr. Chairman, is the fact that one of the stinkiest spots there is some of these so-called designated smoking areas in our public schools. I would hope that this legislation, as we go through with it, will make it so restrictive on smoking in our public schools, we're not going to have any pot smoking either. And I'm a little concerned that this is probably one place where we can educate, perhaps the teachers might not like it, but perhaps if we could strengthen this business about in the public schools alone, if we could completely eliminate any smoking in there. Now, principal teachers and superintendents of the school systems are allowed smoking areas of public schools. Now, to me, that's a violation of the law in the first place, because the law also says that unless you are 18 or over, you can't buy cigarettes or possess them. So, in a sense, by giving designated smoking areas in our public schools, our school officials are doing exactly what we were talking about earlier. They're authorizing the violation of the law in the first place, because those young people, most of the people in high schools are not above 18. We're talking about 18 and under in the elementary and the public schools. This is something to think about. What we were talking about, we make a law and nobody pays any attention to it. Walk on it, but they're still in it.
Should we prohibit smoking in the religious schools too?
Well, perhaps so. It's a public case. But my point is that I hope that we can really nail the school business down. If we nail the school business down, it makes the young people, they're taking our place one day. Perhaps that might be the place we can do the final death nail to this thing that we're trying to do something about. I just wanted to say
High schools, this sounds very naive, do high schools designate areas for students to smoke?
They do.
I thought they
have designated places for high school students, and this is my point. Here they are allowing a violation of the law in the first place, because those young people under 18 are not even supposed to possess cigarettes. They're not supposed to be able to buy them. We've got a state law that says that. How ridiculous can we get?
Thank you, sir. Right. When I was in high school, the smokers would go into the restroom.
Well, we've got a number of fires in schools. I know right in my own place, my own hometown, we had a fire a couple of years ago. And it was cigarette butts. Kids got caught and they threw them right quick. They were hiding. And they dumped them. And it created a fire. They could have burnt the whole damn school down. That's a breaking system. Now I have to get it on my system.
Let me ask you something. There's a reference in the materials that staff has provided to what goes on in other states, for example, Minnesota. Is this bill patterned on anything existing in another state?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we looked at, when I say we, I mean the Alaska Heart Association and another number of people, and they can respond to it later. I think we and they looked at almost all of the other states that are available. We picked and chose and considered Alaska's unique features one thing or another. So I wouldn't say it's patterned after any other, but we, I think it's safe to say that we tried to get best elements out of all of them.
Would this bill, if enacted, be more strict than it exists anywhere else in the country, or is it part of a trend?
Well, I probably would quarrel with the word trend as strict. I think it would be more fair than a great number of others. Perhaps not the fairest, but it would be among the better bills.
All right. Do you gentlemen have anything else you want to do? Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next witness would be Dr. Rambeau of the Department of Health and Social Services. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, on, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Health and Social Services, and we submitted the position paper in May, and I'm sure that many members probably have a copy of it. I allude to it mainly because, much to my horror today, shaking the dust off and looking at it, there's a couple of errors, which I'll get to. But briefly, the department wholeheartedly supports this bill. We think that it's part of enlightened public health policy, and that we very strongly endorse it. There's a couple of minor suggestions we have for improvement, and that's where our errors are. For example, on page 3, not line 14, but line 16, that there is a difficulty in defining a smoker, and that perhaps you might want to restate that to say a place of employment if all the employees consent to the designation in entirety.
Let me ask you about that, because I understand that and have some sympathy with it. However, is there a likelihood of coercion in that situation? There's a tremendous impetus to go along and get along, particularly if the smoker is the boss or supervisor. And I would be concerned about, although I was the one who mentioned consent in one of my other questions, I would be concerned in figuring out whether the consent was really, truly voluntary or was coerced.
Well, if that question was asked 5 years ago, I'd probably give you a different answer. But in the last 5 years, I think it's fair to say that the impetus has switched from in favor of the smoker to the non-smoker. Up until about 5 years ago, I think that the cry that you were infringing on my civil rights and so on carried the day. But I would say that at least the last 5 years, that the non-smoker is probably the more militant of the two creatures, and that the smokers are very definitely one in the minority, and two, they're really fighting for their life, to their right to survive. We have a particular problem in the state government on this question. And of course, you're sitting in a room that is posted, until Senator Fisher put a knot up there, that's posted to smoking permitted.
What's the particular problem?
Well, the problem is that our smokers are in the minority. And the outcries are so loud now that from the non-smokers that they now say that they're being, you know, their civil rights are being infringed against. I'm sure you've all heard the various arguments that are offered. You know, they range from, wife has no right to say anything about the perfume that she or the cologne that he wears and so on. And I find that equally distasteful. I think a lot of it is pure demagoguery. But the point is that it's a very interesting thing. For example, the union will not take a stand on it. We've had, and very unsuccessfully, I might add, despite the testimony about smoke eaters and so on, it is true that there are devices that will help. But I also would point out that the trend in modern office building is more and more interior spaces with less and less windows and depending upon more and more mechanical ventilation. And I might add, quite unsuccessfully. Right at the present time, we have a serious problem in our office, our headquarters in Anchorage, which is a modern office building, because of the fact that we have a number of people that are working in an entirely enclosed interior space, and the ventilation at the best with mechanical aids is still poor. And the question is, how do you resolve and make both sides happy? My idea was, unsuccessful so far, just to set up a smoking room. Just to set up a room where smokers could go and have a smoke. Now, there's a couple problems with that. One is that we have neither the money nor can we find the space in the building to do it.
We get a lot less work out of it.
Not really true. People only will work as hard as they are personally motivated to do. And the argument that a smoker that deprived of mean, the opportunity to smoke while at work will take away if he has to leave his desk, he or she leave her desk to accomplish something that you'll get less work out of him. That is not necessarily true, because there's a counterargument. Alongside of him is the individual that's a non-smoker and who finds smoking distasteful. It's an interesting phenomenon. It's also of relatively recent origin, is that formerly the only argument against it was that I find smoking distasteful. But in 19, let's see, this is 84, in 82, there were 138,000 plus cases of allergies to smoke that were documented. That's quite a few. Now, if there were that many that were documented, there was probably three times that many that weren't documented. See, there's three things about smoking, and I don't want to get into either the philosophical or the regulatory part, because that's not really what our department is there for. But first of all, there is certainly a mounting antipathy to smoking. And the majority of people do not smoke, and they're becoming quite vocal about the fact that you are infringing upon their rights when you smoke in their presence. The second one is that we have too many cases now documented of physiological changes in people from smoke from other people. For example, and we're particularly interested in this state, is that the number of cases of lung air infection in children we find is three times as high if there's a member of a family, immediate household that smokes. And if there's more than one, then we find it's four or five times as high. And I think probably the third, and probably the most, I would consider damaging one, is in 1981, in this state, for example, there were 92 deaths due to cancer of the respiratory systems, which practically are 100% due to smoke, and that there were 145 premature deaths due to coronary disease, a large percentage of which can be linked directly to the effect of smoking on the cardiovascular system. And the last point that I'd like to make is that in many states in the United States, cancer of the respiratory system, of the lungs, has now exceeded cancer of the breast in women as the leading cause of neoplastic death. Now, up until recently, this was not true. You know, this was smoking, as you well know, was strictly mainly a male disease for many decades. And it's only in the last few decades that, with equal rights, and I always think of, what is it, Virginia Slims that has the slogan, "You've come a long way, baby." They sure have, because they finally have caught up to us, and now in pulmonary due to cancer. The only other point that I'd like to make, Senator, a lot of people waiting here, is another suggestion for improvement. It's on page 4 and line 1. And this is a piece of trivia, but we think that if you would add to that, and I quote, per Alaska statute of 1835-300, that it would make the sign more effective. Outside that, if you have to answer any questions, what is it? What is that, Mike? 35-500 is in the bill? Yes, sir. 18.35.300 happens to be the one that says smoking in public places. We just think that it would make that sign more effective. It's a,
oh, I see what you mean.
It's probably, yeah, at the end of it.
So that when you say no smoking, they know there has the authority of law behind it.
That's correct, sir.
That's an excellent I've always allowed Senator Huffman to smoke in this committee because I want to get along. Senator?
Page 3, it says the smoking section may not be designated under A of this section in the area or vehicle unless the area or vehicle meets the minimum ventilation air quality standards adopted by the department. Now, you mentioned the effectiveness of these smoke eaters or whatever. Do you think they're going to, first of all, does this apply to the area? The conversation sounded like it applied to the area other than the area where the smoking was, so it doesn't say that. It says unless the area or vehicle meets the minimum ventilation may not be designated a smoking section. Well, that's the area of the smoking section. Now, the question is, does that mean that the smoking section that people want to go breathe free smoke in has got to meet air quality standards that it can't possibly meet? But number two, is there any way that the devices available now, unless somebody exhales all the smoke into some kind of device, I mean, these things that look like ashtrays can suck all the smoke off the cigarette sitting in an ashtray, but is it effective?
You don't hold that ashtray afraid of your mouth.
But is it effective, technically, in a two-person office, let's say 10 by 20 feet, in the interior of a building, for those devices to meet air quality standards?
I would defer to, the answer probably is yes, because I would defer to the Department of Environmental Conservation to set these standards. I personally, and this is a personal opinion, have never been impressed favorably by, and we've gotten our office across the street here. I've never been impressed by the artificial devices that aid the dispersal of smoke.
Well, as buildings become more energy efficient and more tightly sealed, this problem gets worse. That's part of what you're saying.
Yes, sir. It shouldn't, but it does. Partly because of the fact that in the state of Alaska, we're really not concerned about cooling air, but we're concerned about using the warmth of the air. Now, you take a ventilation system in a building in the southern 48 where air conditioning, in the sense of refrigeration, may be used more than the heating part. Their ventilation systems, by and large, are better. But irrespective of it, if you have large interior areas, and so many of the office buildings now that are designed that way, you know, outside of the privileged few that have offices where they may have windows, of course, a lot of them, the windows you can't open, so really they're nothing but an aesthetic viewpoint. Interior, the difficulty in circulating the air is considerable.
So we really don't have the technology to make this work in a two-person small office.
I'm going to dodge it because they're going to have to tell you what the standards are.
Okay.
And the answer is probably the standards. Now, I'm assuming the standards would be defined liberally enough, but the answer would be yes. You better be able to distinguish the difference between the aesthetic distaste that people have for smoke and the actual harm that can come from being associated with people that smoke. I might point out that like Sandra Moss, I'm an ex-smoker of a number of years, but I still sit in the smoking section of an airplane. It has nothing to do with the fact that people are smoking or not smoking.
Why?
Huh?
More people survive the crash.
No, that's actually, as a matter of fact, even that, my excuse for that is even diminishing, is that you have less, usually there are less small children and infants. But that applies less in Alaska than it does in the U.S.
All right, thank you very much, Dr. Gary Miller, representing the Glen Association.
I actually represent two organizations. I helped form CASP about a year and a half ago. And last month I was elected to the board of directors of the Glen Association. Some of the things I have to say have already been said. So I might as well just jump into some of this. The first thing I'd like to present, in Newsweek, in June 6th of 1983, there was an article on smoking, and they were referring to a forthcoming Gallup poll that showed 38% of the American adults, not everybody, but adults, smoke. Today, 36 states restrict smoking, compared with only 5 in 1971. They also make reference to various surveys, and I quote, "It's no secret that most smokers have an urge to quit. Numerous surveys show that anywhere from 2/3 to 90% wish they didn't have a habit." So I think we can safely say that out of 38%, probably only half of them would really demand a smoking area. Some of the studies that have been done, I've got a bibliography here, and if you're interested in the articles, I'll supply the articles to you. It's a page and a half summary relating to some of the studies on smoking and secondhand smoke. People who smoke cigarettes suffer lung cancer rates 10 times greater than non-smokers. Smoking is related to 20% of all cancers. When cigarettes are consumed, 55 to 65% of the smoke goes into the air. In that tobacco smoke, there are 16 known carcinogens, 13 known co-carcinogens, and 9 tumor initiators. Recent medical research is linking ambient tobacco smoke to health problems. Dr. Takeshi Hirayama, chief epidemiologist at the National Institute of Tokyo, Japan, conducted a study of 91,540 women aged 40 or greater. The study was done over a 14-year period from 1966 to 1979. He found that in urban areas, non-smoking women were 2.4 times more likely to develop lung cancer if their husbands smoked 20 or more cigarettes per day, 1.6 times if less than 20 cigarettes per day. In agricultural areas, non-smoking women whose husbands smoked 2 or more packs per day had 4.6 times greater risk of lung cancer. The reason they thought the difference between urban and rural was because in an urban area there would be more pollution and we normally would have higher lung cancer rates, and so it wouldn't show as much. A study known as the Tecumseh study followed 4,378 children during the years 1959 to 1979. The authors found, and I quote, the prevalence of asthma, wheeze, and chest colds was higher in males, and that of bronchitis and wheeze higher in females both if both parents smoked, unquote. Various measures of lung function were lower for children whose parents smoked. Dr. James R. White and Herman Frohm measured lung function in 2,100 middle-aged subjects. They state, I quote, when we look at the extent to which smoke exposure is related to graded abnormality, we found that non-smokers in smoke-free working environments have the highest scores on the spirometric tests. Passive smokers, smokers who do not inhale, and light smokers score similarly and significantly lower, and heavy smokers scored the lowest. We conclude that chronic exposure to tobacco smoke in the work environment is deleterious to the non-smoker and significantly reduces the small airways function. And the previous speaker told you about the study that was done in ear infections that was done at Children's Orthopedic Hospital in Seattle. One of the things that bothers the tobacco companies is that court cases are currently being won. They're being won based on common law. The court cases so far have pertained mostly to people who are sensitive to smoke, people who have an allergy to it, or people who have emphysema or asthma, and such things as that. One of the things that I think bothers the tobacco industry the most is that these people won their cases not because they're sensitive to smoke, but because they were harmed. They were able to establish that they were physically harmed by the tobacco smoke, even though they were sensitive to the smoke. I'd like to read a paragraph out of the American Journal of Nursing from August of 1983. And this is a paragraph referring to the study that was done in Japan. Another recent study done in Japan by Tikshi Hirayama, MD, indicates that non-smoking wives of smokers have a higher risk of developing lung cancer than wives of non-smokers. His findings reveal a twofold increase in risk for wives of two-pack per day smokers. Shortly after this study was released, the Tobacco Institute, an industry group, announced their consultants found a statistical error in Hirayama's data interpretation that invalidated his conclusions. They subsequently retracted the accusation that they had successfully perpetrated public confusion on the issue. Earlier this summer, there was a conference on smoking, and one of the things that Dr. Hirayama did was go back over his statistics and look for other ways to either validate or invalidate the study. And going over it, he found that it was even more conclusive than what they had first thought. And I think one of the reasons the tobacco industry is upset now is they now have to look at potential court cases where people who are not sensitive to allergy, emphysema, or asthma may be able to establish that they are physically being harmed by the tobacco smoke. And one of the things that was brought up was cost, and a concern, especially where I work with the state, is the cost of trying to accommodate a new legislation such as this. And I would like to point out that the Alaska Department of Labor's Research and Analysis Unit reported an average monthly number of state employees for 1980 at 15,370. In 1981, the American Cancer Society reported that the average pack-a-day smoker cost the company between $625 and $750 per year in increased expenses. Smokers have absenteeism rates which are 40 to 50% higher than non-smokers and at least 50% more health care needs. A survey by APA in 1983 showed that 26% of its membership smokes. Taking 26% times 15,270 employees works out to 3,996 smoking state employees. At $625 per year, that works out to $2,497,500. At the upper figure of $750, that works out to $2,997,000. And those figures are based on 1981. Assuming the costs have risen, I would assume that the upper figure would exceed $3 million. I think that in the case of the state for $3 million, and considering the length of time that it would recover its money fairly rapidly if it ended up having to make expenses.
That figure represents what again?
Okay, those figures represent, the American Cancer Society stated that the cost to a company is between $625 and $750 per year. They're looking at things such as sick leave taken, damage to furniture, increased cost of air ventilation, that type of thing. And there, in 1980, the census showed that there were 15,370 employees in the state, employees.
Some of those costs we would still incur because the employee would smoke on his or her own time, I suppose. You have to control that. In terms of sick leave costs.
You would still have that problem, right? But you would not, you should have not any of the damage is done to furniture outside the smoking area, and you would be limiting sort of more rigid control for air quality only within that smoking amount or whatever if you designated that in your area.
Senator Moss. I told you it's those statistics. Yeah, but I'm just curious, you know, part of the thing from statistics there, I'm just wondering, you know, how many students in primary and secondary school smoke?
No, I don't.
I mean, I just thought maybe perhaps you might run across some of that in your.
I'm sorry, I don't have that information. And then I'd sort of like to make a few interesting comments on some of the things that have brought up before. One of the things, one of the concerns, and that was a concern last year, was enforcement. I think that if you give the public the means of complaining, they will. I have currently complained to our director, our commissioner, to the Commission of Health and Social Services, to OSHA, the APA, and including the governor's office, and I've had a negative response from all those individuals. If the statute goes through and gives me the means, I as an individual would pick up on it and would be pleased to pick up on it. But the second thing is your sample of, or example referring to computer rooms. One of the things that happened in New Jersey, they had a person who was sensitive to tobacco smoke, and they lost a court case. New Jersey Bell was ordered to segregate their smokers and non-smokers. The reason being, they prohibited smoking in the computer room because of its harmful effect on the equipment, and yet they were ignoring this individual's lungs. And that was fought in one of the court cases. Our computer room at the Department of Labor currently prohibits it because it is harmful to machinery. We have a very valuable machine, and we can't afford to have something happen to it. And yet, where I work, I have three people sitting around with smoke. I have requested to be moved. When we moved into our building a year and a half ago, I requested that we segregate smokers and non-smokers, and it's not done. We're getting brand new furniture throughout most of the building, which means disruption and shifting of the gas board again when we return down again. The other thing was on enforcement. The people most likely to violate it would be the smokers going to non-smoking area and smoking in that area. And from what I've been told by most smokers, they are law-abiding citizens, and that would not be a problem. And I think most smokers are law-abiding, so I think it's going to be a minority of people who are going to actually create a problem. It was brought up to the possibility of discrimination for not hiring an individual who smokes. There are currently five departments that I'm aware of at the state that I've talked with various people. Most supervisors currently refuse to hire smokers because they have a non-smoking office and they don't want smokers there. I believe if you check with the ombudsman office, you find they've already received complaints on that and they've looked into it. It's my understanding that it is legal to discriminate against a person who smokes because there's a choice that they make. It is not something such as sex or race that you have no control over. It's something you have control over. It hasn't been brought out yet. And I hope
of course, that's interesting in the way it's an addiction or disease that you would have. Go ahead, I just
rather than have to still initially take that first step before they become addicted. So to that extent, it still is their choice. And then I'd also like to point out, I don't know if you have anything in your packets or files, whatever you have here, but the Alaska Medical Association, the Alaska Nurses Association, and this last week, the Alaska Dental Society have all passed resolutions in support of this bill. And if we don't have copies of them, I'd be pleased to supply copies of those to you for the official record.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We'd like to have those copies, sir.
Okay, I'll get copies of those and make sure that they come to you.
Any questions? Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Roberta Banco.
Right to decide to smoke, if that's what they want to do, even though the statistics are so overwhelming about it being the most prevalent cause of preventable death in our country. The decision not to smoke, though, should be, I think, at least as sacred. I feel that it's just like the right to swing your fist or do anything else in a society such as ours that ends with somebody else's nose, and that you're infringing on one person's rights by a habit that you're pursuing, then you should be the one to limit your activity. As Gary pointed out, over two-thirds of the public in general are considered non-smokers, so we're talking about a minority of the people, in effect, having an effect on the rest of the population. As far as public places goes, that's one thing, like Representative Miller pointed out, some public places you can choose not to go to a restaurant, for example, but a person can't choose not to go to work. And a lot of us have tried at work to institute some mutually acceptable alternatives to the problem, and we're met with varying degrees and types of responses. For example, I was met with a response by one director of the fact that the law is on my side. I have the right to establish this entire building as a smoking area if I so desire, and that's what I desire to do, and therefore that's the way it is. Recently, we've had a few positive inroads in that area where we've had at least some accommodations, but the point is that at this time, without any statute or provision for it, it's a matter of personal whim. If a person is smoking, they won't allow everybody to smoke, and that's fine. If they aren't, then, you know, then they can then make accommodations. People with severe health problems, which are aggravated by cigarette smoke from time to time, are even treated as troublemakers and ostracized in the office situation when all they're asking for is white, breath, clean air. And as you know, the courts are coming down with cases every day. There's volumes of those available. And we'd like to see the state of Alaska take some initiative in checking the trend of court cases and this kind of thing. It would be a lot better to go ahead and institute a law, I think, that would be something livable for everybody. And most of my friends who are smokers have, they know about my interest in the bill and so forth, and I get joked a lot about it, but they have assured me that they are, as Gary pointed out, they're law-abiding citizens, and if it's a posted non-smoking area, people don't insist on smoking at church or in the theater and in places where it's already designated. And I've had a few of my friends who smoke say that they would welcome it because it would take it away from them. It would take it out of their hands. And if they're not sitting there with a cigarette going in their ashtray, that's the biggest problem in my office. It's not the smoke that they're inhaling and then blowing out through their nose. It's the cigarette that's sitting in the ashtray burning while they're entering into the computer terminal or typing or whatever. The habit of lighting the cigarette is the habit that we're dealing with, not the, as you pointed out, the addictive need for the nicotine rush or whatever that people are getting from it. So this would be eliminating, and of course, we'd have to then think about what they're doing and get up and move to a designated spot or have their desk located in a designated spot to make it impossible for them to smoke. And we trust in your judgment and in your ability to see the problem and solve it, whether it means building smokeless environments or adding ventilation and all this kind of stuff is talking about a lot of money, and simply restricting smoking in certain areas would take a lot of that potential high cost out of the problem. I'm told that our building, I've been told for a year and a half, before we were in the building room now, I was told that when we get in our new building, everything will be better because it's a new building and it's going to have better ventilation. And then we got in the new building and the ventilation has never worked ever since we've been there, and we're told not to open the windows because it throws off the balance of the ventilation system. The windows aren't very good ones anyway. They just open out at a slant and don't offer any cross ventilation. And then finally, after about 8 months, they hired somebody to come in and balance the system. And I talked to the man who's the technician the other day about that. I asked him, when the system is finally balanced, if and when this happens, if this will take care of the problem to any extent. And he said that it would not, that these systems are not set up to take smoke out of the air, and that in order to do that, they would have to add filtration devices and so forth. So I'd like to see a complete ban on smoking in any public place whatsoever, but I think this is a really good compromise that does speak to the rights of the smokers to continue their habit. And I think in this day and age, a person would be really ill-informed to actually state that there's no evidence of harmful effects of ambient cigarette smoke inhalation. And in some ways, it appears a matter of degree, but certainly should not be included in job duties for public employees to be subjected to menace like this. And we've had cases of grievances with the union, and we've had quite a few petitions. I have with me today a petition with 496 signatures that we got out of the mall in one afternoon in support of House Bill 84, which I'd like you to have. Another is a petition of people who work in the building that I work in, the Department of Labor building over on the Plywood Palace over there by the bridge, which has 70, almost 80 signatures, which is quite a large majority of the workers there in our department who are in support of House Bill 84. I have a letter, a resolution from the local chapter of APEA. Now, APEA, as an overall statewide organization, is not taking a stand on the bill, as you may know, because of the controversy involved. However, our local Juneau chapter, which represents the workers in Juneau, voted unanimously to support House Bill 84. Here's a copy of that. Also, here is a copy of existing statute, section 18.60.075, Safe Employment, section A, part A, I guess. An employer shall do everything necessary to protect the life, health, and safety of employees, including but not limited to, and I guess some of the others. And I think that the duty is clear that the employer has the obligation to protect the health of people that work for them. And I think this bill does a lot to at least start a trend in that direction. I'd like to see Alaska take the initiative in that. So thank you very much.
Okay, there. My name is Marilyn Martin. I contacted all 20 senators a few weeks ago, giving you a letter with what I considered to be very important legal developments related to this issue. I'm one of the 46% of the population who is allergic to cigarette smoke. An allergist tested me in 1967, and he said, "You're allergic, stay away from it." I have to work, however, and so that's been my main interest in since the early 70s. There are two kinds of employees now in the United States. There are protected ones and there are unprotected. Protected employees, for example, are those in San Francisco. Very well known election was held, you know, that bill passed. So they're now in the process of changing their office procedures and possibly structures to accommodate smokers and non-smokers. In Anchorage, the Municipal Health Department is gradually phasing in a no-smoking program, and by a few months from now, I believe it is, the entire health building in Anchorage will be considered non-smoking, no smoking at all. Non-protected employees have had to resort to legal efforts to try to remain employed. In the state of Alaska, two state Department of Labor employees have collected worker compensation. One collected almost over $1,000, about $1,650, and I'm not sure how much the other one has collected yet. The more critical type of legal action has had to be taken by people who are allergic or hypersensitive to smoke have consisted of two cases that were came out of federal courts in 1982. One was a U.S. District Court case in Seattle, wherein a hypersensitive employee was deemed to be covered by the Federal Handicapped Worker Act. He dealt with those provisions. And the most important one came out of the San Francisco, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which sits at the right hand of God, and it deemed a hypersensitive to cigarette smoke federal employee as having a, quote, they termed a new term, an environmental limitation, and they said that she was entitled to disability retirement. And the one point I would like to make is that if 6% of the population is allergic to smoke, and with the large number of workers that the state of Alaska employs, what would be the fiscal impact on the state of Alaska if they went after worker compensation or through the court for protection? So please support this bill.
Mr. Lauber, representing the Tobacco Institute. Shows that there is no unchallengeable authority, that it is. Two studies were mentioned previously, the Japanese study regarding wives of smokers and also the White Probe study. These are the most often cited by the proponents of this type of legislation. And both of those studies have been challenged not by the Tobacco Institute, but other independent scientists. And for their methodology and design of the study, challenging its conclusions, and so forth. One scientist labeled the White Probe study by Dr. White, who in fact is not a medical doctor or a scientist, but has a doctorate in physical education, labeled it as the methodology is not scientific, but that of a layperson with convictions. We're confronted with people entering into studies that have a conclusion they wish to reach, and then reaching that conclusion through their studies that is not scientific. I think that the most interesting and obviously one that one could not have challenged is being on the side of the Tobacco Institute that would challenge this finding is the most recent, I believe, Surgeon General's report in 1982, and it states in part, the available evidence is not sufficient to conclude that other persons' smoke causes disease in non-smokers, end of quote. Another authority, Dr. Moser, professor of medicine and director of pulmonary division at the University Hospital, the University of California, stated, in my opinion, there is not now a sufficient body of hard facts to support the view that public smoking poses a health hazard to the lungs of the non-smoker. If there were, I would be the first to press for a legislative remedy. The data are not there. I'm not one to say that if you want to make an emotional judgment on an issue, that it's not one's prerogative. But at least you ought to tell people that's what you are doing.
also another person that would not be considered to be in the pocket of the Tobacco Institute is Dr. Jonathan Rhodes, the chairman of the National Council of National Cancer Advisory Board. Instead of talking about secondhand smoke, says, quote, it is not, in fact, actually harmful, unquote. Another person known to the proponents of this type of legislation is Dr. Collier Hammond of the American Cancer Society. He states that there, quote, was no shred of evidence that a non-smoker can get cancer from secondhand smoke, and to suggest that passive smoking could cause cancer is dishonest.
What about leaving cancer aside? What about heart and respiratory?
Previous comments I made reference to general health. The last one only talked about cancer.
Because in the newspaper article of June 6th, I noticed that it said there that preliminary studies have suggested other potentially explosive findings. Cigarette smoke may also have injured the hearts and lungs of those who do not smoke. Citing a study by Dr. Aaron Hall of Creighton University and Dr. Grove of the University of California.
I'm not familiar with the first. The second is not. I'll leave a copy of a critique of the Grove study that was published in the Congressional Record, and it was by Dr. Leibowitz. There also has been some comments regarding allergies and some contention that persons are allergic to tobacco smoke. In the testimony and the comments that people make, it is oftentimes difficult to distinguish between whether they're talking about allergies to tobacco or allergies to tobacco smoke. A Mayo Clinic study, now speaking about tobacco smoke, said that they are unable to find allergy to tobacco and tobacco smoke in the subjects that they have studied. Another authority, Dr. Melvin First of the Harvard School of Public Health, said there is as yet no proof that specific sensitization to tobacco smoke exists. No doubt that there are people that are annoyed by tobacco smoke, as people are annoyed about other people's behavior. In fact, in testimony before a congressional committee, a professor at the Harvard Medical School of Psychiatry stated that to some people, the smoker himself is an annoyance. These hostile confrontations point to an antagonism that possibly stems from basic deference in lifestyle. In a society where tensions and anxieties give rise to anger and frustration, there is always a danger of allowing pressure groups to influence legislation restricting individual freedoms simply to alleviate annoyances of another segment of the society. Now going on to the second finding, which is that recent court decision recognized an emerging right of employees to work in a smoke-free environment. That is not really the case. At least at the time this legislation was drafted in the better part of last year, that statement was not factual, and I know of nothing to contradict it. There have been cases where people with some type of an ailment have been successful in filing workman's compensation claims, and that may or may not be related to smoking. But that is a far different case than a citing for this legislation of the emerging right of employees to work in a smoke-free environment. The one case that was referred to earlier, which is was mentioned, the New Jersey Bell, a 1976 case, it's Shimp versus New Jersey Bell, is correct. The court in that case did find a right. What the interesting thing was that the case was not defended. It was, in effect, a default judgment. New Jersey Bell did not defend the case. 2 years later, another case arose in New Jersey and against the same company, New Jersey Bell. And at that time, the company elected to defend the case. They went to court and, interestingly enough, had the same judge. And that judge, after hearing evidence on the other side, did not arrive at the same conclusion. So while the case was not overturned, the same set of facts were, in fact, overturned. And that one case, as to my knowledge, the only one, the one that, in fact, went by default, where there was a finding in a private business, New Jersey Bell, not in a public, like for the state or city or something like that. I did not bring it with me, I thought I did, but a series of cases, all of the cases, both favorable and unfavorable, as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry, I guess I don't have it. But I will supply that to you for your information. I think you will find it interesting to substantiate the fact that if, in fact, there is an emerging right, it's certainly a minority opinion of the courts. And this thing has been all the way to the United States Supreme Court on several occasions, and they have not ruled as such. Now, the third finding, I think, is inappropriate for the type of legislation. It might be an interesting advertisement for the proponents of this type of legislation, and probably aimed at what their true desire is, and that is to restrict all smoking by all persons at all times. And in fact, in this legislation, it's not necessary. It has nothing to do with secondhand smoke. It deals only with the costs and so forth of smoking, and makes a gratuitous statement that is absolutely not necessary. I won't belabor the point, but I don't think that it is necessary for this particular piece of legislation. By the way, the present law,
I think you made the point that
the present
rationale for the rationale for the legislation is to protect the health of those who do not smoke. And the Section 1.3 addresses people who do smoke.
That's correct. It doesn't address the issue. It's a statement, and it's a finding of fact that is not necessary to the either success or failure of this legislation.
That's that.
I'd like to comment on item 3 there. It's a very interesting thing that recently I was changing my insurance company on my automobile insurance. And at that time, the agent was aware that I had quit smoking and pointed out to me that I had the opportunity to get a 5% discount in my insurance rates. I guess my point is that we don't have a problem here with smoking, and why, since I quit smoking, but they give me a 5% discount in my insurance. That's a pretty fair size insurance company, too.
Well, to answer that, Mr. Chairman, if I might, if the insurance agent had been willing to give you a 5% discount because you worked in an area where no one else smoked, that might be of interest in this legislation. But the fact that, and I likewise, being a non-smoker, get benefits on my insurance from not smoking, but it has nothing to do with passive smoke or secondhand smoke or whether other people smoke. They don't give me any benefits for that. And that's the only reason I cite it. If at some other time the issue wants to rise and the state wants to propose a constitutional amendment of some sort, I guess it would be germane. But at this time, I don't think it is. I don't want to belabor that point. But
I don't need to. I'm not talking about item 3.
That's what I'm talking about, is item 3.
It says that it's talking about people who smoke. And I don't smoke anymore, so I got a 5% discount. I mean,
I think the point here is that the ostensible object of the bill is not to reduce the level of smoking among Alaskans, except as far as the public education clause goes, but it isn't to prohibit Alaskans from smoking. And I suppose, Mr. Miller may contradict me, but I suppose that if people wouldn't smoke in public places or in the job site, it wouldn't matter if the proponents, if people want to smoke 5 packs a day somewhere else. So if that is the correct premise, then the question is whether the finding should address the problems of people who smoke as distinct from the problems of people who are around smokers.
The Another issue, by the way, the original bill, not the bill, excuse me, the statute on the books now, states that smoking in any form may constitute a nuisance and is prohibited in the following area. I suggest that that is sufficient language because it's almost the old tree falling in the forest. If there's no one there to hear it, it doesn't make any noise. And in this case, it's not a nuisance as long as it's not objectionable to some person. And if the smoking is done in a way that is not objectionable, then it's no longer a nuisance. So it's not necessarily the smoking that is the nuisance. It's that it is done around someone that finds it objectionable. And so I think that it may be a nuisance to some people, but it is not necessarily a nuisance. They also have in that bill that it is a health hazard, and I refer to my previous statements that they're non-biased, apparently, reports of the Surgeon General and other medical authorities not connected with the Tobacco Institute state that secondhand smoke is, in fact, not a health issue. Another thing I think is...
They don't say that. They don't say that secondhand smoke is not a health hazard. They say that studies have suggested it is a health hazard but are questionable by methodology.
Let me make that clear. I don't want to leave you with that impression. That's not what I'm saying.
Studies.
That's not what they're saying.
Neither study for expertise.
I'm not just challenging their studies. This is independent of those studies. There were challenges to those studies, but independent of those, the statement that I made regarding the Surgeon General's report, making no reference to any other studies, is that, quote, the available evidence is not sufficient to conclude that other people's smoke causes disease in non-smokers, unquote. It's not challenging any report. It's just saying specifically that they...
My point is well taken. That the study doesn't say... Yes. I judge that. The Surgeon General is not saying that he finds that it is not hazardous to the health of non-smokers to be exposed to secondhand smoke. He's only saying that the evidence that it is hazardous does not exist. There's a difference.
I see what you mean. Just following up on that point, the specific language, as I hear, the Surgeon General said that secondhand smoke does not cause disease, but it may well aggravate, it may well do other things. I think the key word was cause.
Well, you're reading something that wasn't necessarily in that.
I'm just responding to what I heard you say.
It could be possible, but I think that there are other segments of that report. I don't have excerpts from the 82 report, but excerpts from the 79 Surgeon General's report would indicate that it probably does not create any significant problems in anyone. There are certainly exceptions, but again, we'll get back to this allergy thing. The difference between taping a cigarette leaf to your hand and saying you're allergic and an allergy from secondhand smoke. Group of people that smoke that may be allergic to their smoke. That's possible. But this bill is dealing with secondhand smoke, and that's what I'm trying to direct the attention only to that issue. And in previous testimony, people have bounced back and forth without making a clear distinction between smoking, in other words, a person doing it, and the secondhand smoke. And at times, I think it's hard for me to follow, and I assume it would be hard for the committee to follow.
Mr. Chairman, I might mention it. I've been able to follow that particular point all the way through because I look at it in terms of the effect of smoking on the innocent bystander. That's essentially the testimony I've heard from the people who are testifying, from the State Department of Labor. They talk about the effect of others smoking upon their helping their attempts to get away from those who smoke and so on. So I follow the distinction you make, just like the third finding there, I fully agree.
One of the interesting things is that this 1975 bill we have on the books was one of the original, and it was, and still is, it's funny that it was one of the stiffest bills on the books. Although not the fault of the legislature. It, quite frankly, has not been enforced, and maybe someone can tell me the exact date, but I don't believe the regulations, even though the bill was passed in 1975, regulations were promulgated until maybe 2 years ago. And the amount of money and time and effort spent in enforcing it has really been minimal. In other words, it just hasn't really been given any kind of a test to see whether it's workable, because there hasn't been much enforcement of the what bill there is. The other thing that this bill does, and I think this is presumptuous of this legislature, particularly dealing with other legislative bodies, is to force this particular legislation upon other municipalities. Again, it states that they have the power to legislate if they so desire regarding their own meeting